This talk was given by Patrick Yunan Kelly at the Zen Center of New York City. Yunan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ccnyc. Thanks for listening.
So, what we really want to do is serve happiness. We want everyone to be happy, never unhappy, even for a moment. We want the animals to be happy. The happiness of every living thing is what we want. We want it very much, but we cannot bring it about. We cannot make even one individual happy. It seems that this thing that we want most of all is out of our reach. The confusion is due to our lack of awareness of real happiness. Happiness is pervasive. It does not appear and disappear. It is not sometimes more and sometimes less. It is our awareness of happiness that goes up and down. Happiness is our real condition. It is reality. It is life. So this passage I got from a documentary that I saw a few weeks ago about the life of the painter Agnes Martin. And so she's reading this, and I don't actually know what the source of it is. It sounds very much like a Zen teaching, as I can tell. I feel like it must have been. She was had a lifelong interest in Zen. And seems to have been a sort of, I don't know if she was a formal or an informal Zen student, but it seems like she was a student. I tried to, I actually tried to freeze the frame and zoom in on it, and I couldn't see the title of the book. I also tried to Google it, and I got a hit that said this article, 12 Reasons You're Not As Happy As You Should Be. And I thought, 12? That seems like a bit of overkill. And the next hit was, don't try to be happy. We're programmed to be dissatisfied. So I abandoned Google after that. And so as I was preparing this talk, the other question, I was also working with this question. Someone asked me a few weeks ago, what have you gotten out of Zen practice? And I tried to answer, and I don't think I did a very good job. And I thought, that's a good question. And so I'm going to try to work that into this talk as well. And I don't know how this is going to come out. I had a whole thing written last night, and it was like 11 o'clock. And then I was working through it, trying to embody it. And I was just, I'm like, yeah, I'm just not feeling this. So I got rid of everything, and I kind of started over. So I have a lot of stuff here, and this is going to be a little bit of, you know, there are going to be some twists and turns, I think, but hopefully I'm going to be able to offer something that will be useful for you. You know, I've done a couple of talks now, and I'm Hojin Sensei mentioned in a talk not too long ago, there's a list of the five fears of a bodhisattva, and the last one is speaking before a public assembly. And it's not something that I've acutely been aware of, but there's something about the combination of trying to offer something and being in front of people, but also being vulnerable enough to offer something genuine it's a powerful mix. I was thinking not too long ago at the monastery. I don't know if any of you know Jinpu. She used to be a monastic for years, and then she left, and she's been working with dying people as a hospice chaplain for about 20 years. She gave a talk, and the first thing that she said was, I'm so nervous. So I was also remembering, if any of you know Choko, he told me, so when people become a senior student, you do your first talk. It's accompanied by this. It's all these, you know, bells. It's a big ceremony. And then at the end of the talk, you sort of, you're asked to, the Sangha challenges you on your understanding of the koan. So you've been working on a koan, sort of this Zen tool for insight for a whole week. And Choko told me that you know, the last night that he met with Daito Roshi before he went up here, Daito looked at him and said, you seem not to have much insight into this koan. And Choko said, well, what am I going to do? You have to do it. So, thank you, Choko. Another analogy, you know, and coming up with these things, part of the reason I was interested in Agnes Martin is I have a painting practice myself. I don't know that I would call myself a painter, but I do have an ongoing practice. And so something that happens to me when I do this, I get really into it, and I get really sometimes really worked up, and there's this tension between trying to control it and get it. You know, I have this idea of what a good painting would be like, and I end up sometimes struggling with myself, even fighting with myself. And usually, what happens is if that tension goes on long enough, I have a bit of a freak out, and but that releases tremendous energy when that happens. I sometimes feel like maybe it doesn't have to be so dramatic, but it seems to be the way that I work, at least right now. And so when that energy comes forth, sometimes it creates something unexpected that I couldn't, you know, see before. But sometimes it goes wrong, and I end up, you know, attacking the painting, and I'll tear it up. Or at one point, I got so worked up that it took all my restraint not to eat the paint. And thankfully, I didn't, because you know, this stuff, it has like cadmium and heavy metals in it. And then this is a long preface. One other thing I remembered was, when I was practicing I used to practice at the San Francisco Zen Center a long time ago in the mid-90s. And so my MO was, they used to open every day at 5:40 p.m. for the evening sit for two periods. And I was so, I'm not sure why, but I was really worried about, I didn't want people to get to know me, and I didn't want to get to know people. I was afraid that they would, I don't know what I was afraid of, that they would see who I was and reject me or something. But so I would wait around the block till like 5:35, and then I would go up to the door and right at the door, and then sit down right as the bell was ringing in the gaitan, and I'd sit my two periods, and I'd be out, you know, at the end of the two periods. And I did this for 3 years. I mean, I guess I was drawn enough to the practice that I was, it wasn't going to stop me. But and so after a couple of years, I did Nango with them, and they have this, they actually work with people in such a way that they have people there do beginner's talks. So, you know, it's your first Ango. They invite you to come up here with the mic, the whole setup, and give a talk. And so I was, you know, I felt, well, I'm certainly not going to volunteer, but if someone asks me, I will do it. And someone tapped me on the shoulder and asked me, and so I did it. And I started talking, and after about, it couldn't, you know, it seemed like half an hour to me, but it was probably not more than like 2 minutes. I just froze, and I couldn't say anything. The words just failed me. And so I was just sitting there, all these people. And eventually, they started, you know, asking me questions, and they drew me out. And it, you know, I got through it. But it felt like a catastrophe at the time. But even so, I didn't have, even in the midst of it, I felt, I don't have any regrets about doing this. So what if it's a catastrophe? So the point about, to get back to the quote that I started with, one of the things that has really resonated with me the last few weeks is this, we want everyone to be happy, never unhappy, even for a moment. We want the animals to be happy. So if you've been paying attention to the news, there's been a lot lately about climate change and the effect on the other beings that we share this planet with. So there was an article in the journal Science just last week where they modeled the CO2 concentrations, and they concluded that there was a mass extinction at the end of the Permian age, so 252 million years ago, in which 96% of all species on the planet died. And they modeled this, and they concluded that it was due to CO2 concentrations from volcanoes in that particular instance. But they concluded that we're on track to, in a couple of centuries, to have a similar result. And then the other thing that really got to me was there was an article a few weeks ago about they called it the insect apocalypse. Maybe some of you saw this. And it appears that insect populations are crashing around the world. And to be honest, I couldn't read the whole thing. It was too painful for me. I mean to go back, but I was just working with it, and I realized that I felt this grief. And I always look in the comment sections of these articles, and it seemed to me that often there were two often there's two responses. One is to maybe deny in some way that this is happening, which I can find in myself, or almost a sort of like, bitter disappointment in human beings that feels like almost a sort of like angry, maybe kind of nihilism, like we don't deserve to be here. And my feeling is that, no, actually we do deserve to be here. We have everything that we need to address these things, but... Well, let me say more about that in a minute. But the other thing that struck me was in the article, in the part that I did get through, they quote the biologist E.O. Wilson, who says that people have spoken that sort of geologists have names for all these epochs and eras, and there's been some debate that we should maybe call this particular age the Anthropocene, so the age of human beings, because we have become the predominant geological force on the planet. He said, "No, we should name it the Eramocene, which means the age of loneliness." And so I was thinking about these bugs. I didn't realize that I felt so strongly about bugs before. But then I remembered a couple of years ago I did a long hermitage up on the mountain above the monastery. And so in hermitage practice, you're there just by yourself. There's no real direction, but usually the idea, as I understand it, is you do zazen. You get up every once in a while to cook, maybe stretch your legs for a bit, but you're by yourself. And so I'd been up there for about 2 weeks, and I'd been pretty paranoid about getting Lyme disease because there's a lot of ticks up there. And so after about 2 weeks, I got a fever, and I was at night. And when you get a fever and you start hallucinating a little bit, and you get these really weird, far out dreams. And in my dreams, I was feeling that the ticks and the mosquitoes were talking to me, and they were saying, they said, "Yunin, come, forget the human world. Come live with us in the grass and on the backs of the deer and the mice. Come, Yunin." And, this felt like a real thing to me. And I was like, no. and obviously I didn't decide to go with him. But it struck me. And then this morning I was just sitting with my feeling about this this article. I got up early to sit before I came here. And I was sitting. And there's a little shelf in front of me. And as I was sitting... I'm not kidding, this cockroach crawled out and stood on the end of the shelf and sort of and looked at me and turned around and scurried away. So if roaches and ticks and mosquitoes are difficult to relate to, maybe it's you know, it's more helpful to look at something like bees. If you're ever at the monastery, I love to go up when I'm doing sesshin. If I get a little bit of time, especially in the summer, you go over to the beehives and just watch them come in and out. They're such beautiful animals. But I wanted to get back to so how to deal with this, you know, this feeling of grief. And it may be the sort of environmental stuff or, you know, some of the social justice stuff. I mean, there's so much going on in the world these days. It seems so overwhelming. I was thinking about this this man who you probably heard about, I think it was last April, who immolated himself in Prospect Park. His name was David. And in the, what he left behind, the note, he said that that he was concerned that he was doing to himself as a sort of warning sign, consuming himself with fossil fuel as a gesture. He said, "Here's a hope that giving a life might bring some attention to the need for expanded action." And so it's you know, it's impossible to know what's going through someone's mind like that, but I feel I was just feeling his presence, you know, and actually feeling gratitude for what he did. You know, I read also that he was interested in Buddhist practice, so it's conceivable, you know, being a Brooklyn person, that he came by here at some point. So, you know, and what I think what he articulated was this sense of grief that when we face these things, it can feel so large and so overwhelming that we don't know what to do, and so we turn away or deny or just shut down. But the you know, the teachings address this, and we can work with this actually. So this is a quote from Reggie Ray, who's a teacher in the Trungpa lineage. He says, there come times when we are really lost. The journey has proceeded to such a point that we have lost our bearings. We don't know who we are, we don't know where we are, and we don't know what we think. At this point, we need to turn to the antidote that underlies all others. And this is the remedy of devotion. So this is surprising, because when you say this is a non-theistic practice, right? The Buddha does not exist outside of you. But on the other hand, we work with teachers, we work with Sangha, we work with people who are outside of us. It can be helpful. He says, in fact, devotion is the most subtle and sophisticated attitude that a person can have toward reality. So powerful is genuine devotion that once we fully acknowledge that we have lost the thread and all hope of finding the way, the answer is already there. So, you know, I also, since he is using the language of devotion, I thought of, it came up for me as a quote from the Bible, from the book of Job, where he is afflicted, he loses all of his children, he's afflicted with horrible sores, all of his property is lost. And one of his comforters says to him, "Curse God and die. Why bother to go on?" And his response is, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed is the name of the Lord." So what I understand from that is, you know, the giving is a gift. The taking away is also a gift. Dogen says, if you study giving closely, you see that to accept the body and to give up the body are both acts of giving. But still there's these states of mind that seem unbearable. Maybe one way to think about them that works for me is to think of them as sort of demons. While I'm on the subject of you know, devotion, if you have gods, you have demons, you know. You can't have one without the other. But it can be interesting and instructive to really... So usually if you know, a demon arrives, whether it's in the form of another person or some part of ourselves that we don't like, usually, you know, we say, get away. I don't want to see your face. Get out of here. I don't want to deal with you. But, you know, think about what that must be like from the point of view of the demon. You know, you have, I think of them as they're like assigned to some person. You know, you've got one on each shoulder maybe, and sort of like a familiar. And they're trying to tell you something. They keep coming. They want to tell you something. They have something important for you to know. And every time they show their face, get out of here, go away. You know, who's the demon in that picture? But we can, you know, we can work with them and try and ask them, you know, what do you want? What do you actually need? And the in some of the Vajrayana traditions, I find it helpful. There's ways of working with some of these sort of demons or characters in a very explicit way. And in a sense, of course, they're just aspects of ourselves and everything that we encounter. There's a Tibetan text called the 84 Mahasiddhas, which is stories, biographies of enlightened practitioners from medieval India. And it's interesting that you know, we might imagine that they're all sort of, you know, ascetics, or, you know, but they're actually not. They come from all different aspects of the society at that time. So one of the biographies is Siddha Ajogi, the rejected wastrel. Siddha Mani Badra, the happy housewife. Siddha Medini, the tired farmer. And there's one whose name is the loud-mouthed Brahmin. So these are enlightened practitioners. You know, I think I encounter some of these in my daily work life. I was thinking, you know, some of the people I encounter, maybe they're, you know, the stressed out barista, the depressed grad student. I mean, are they enlightened or not? How would I know? I don't even know if I am. So, just to go back to the beginning, when we ask, what do you get out of practice? Maybe we often come to practice, we have something, maybe we want some sort of anxiety, to quiet some sort of anxiety, or to find some sort of peace of mind or stillness. And that does happen after a while. That does result from practice. But then soon enough, you know, once you get settled, it happens very quickly, in fact, that you're given something to do. You know, we get up, we sit down for half an hour, but then we get up right after that and we do kinhin. It's not just a chance to stretch your legs, it's a practice. There's the stilling the mind practice, and then there's entering into activity practice. Kinhin actually means moving the sutra. So the question, so we move the sutra through the zendo, and then we move it out the door and down the street. How does the sutra move on the subway? I actually have I've had this for a few years. I have a practice when I, you know, I try to remember it. I don't always, but when I enter the subway, I have a gatha that I recite to myself. I say, in boarding the subway, I vow with all sentient beings to enter the great vehicle of the Mahayana. And so what do you get out of practice? Or we sometimes say you get absolutely nothing. And this is true, I think. And it's difficult to tolerate, but it's also, it's not exactly what we may think it is. The reason we don't get anything is that we don't lack anything. Is our awareness of happiness that goes up and down. But happiness is our real condition. It is reality. It is life. And our practice as bodhisattvas is to really realize this and to bring it to life. So, Shanti Deva, I just close. For as long as space endures, and for as long as sentient beings remain, for so long may I too remain to dispel the misery of the world.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.